This audio is a recording of a meeting at Showmus 3 on the topic of social centres. In it, several people give their experiences of different social centres in Europe and North America. You can find more audio at www.wsm.ie.
Maybe I'll just introduce what's going on and people who are going to give kind of brief presentations. I'm Mick for the people that don't know me. Basically, around a month ago in Shrewsbury, we kind of took one Sunday to think about the kind of long-term project that we're involved in and the politics of it, and to think a little bit about where we wanted to take the project and what the political dimensions of the project were, because we were very busy with kind of day-to-day running of the place and those kind of issues. And a number of kind of things emerged out of that, or a number of different kind of conversations started that we wanted to continue by holding a series of meetings. And one of those conversations was about the politics of migration and how that might relate to social centre politics. So the first meeting on that issue was a couple of weeks ago, and there'll be more after Christmas. And the second kind of strand, if you like, was related to the politics of social centres. Which is obviously something we've talked about before when we had the social centre gathering in March. When we had the social centre gathering in March, and at other points. But basically, we were just thinking of ways that we could find a further discussion of social centres. What's the political potential of social centres? What are the different kind of ways of using a social centre? So the idea today is to kind of continue that discussion and to kind of kick it off with a few brief presentations. So I think Andrew's going to start off talking about his experiences travelling around North America and visiting quite a lot of projects there. And then Crosby's going to talk about a particular project in Glasgow, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then I'm going to talk about some projects in Spain that are sometimes referred to as second generation social centres. And
I don't know what I see.
Okay.
Sorry.
Well, and anyway, I'm sure after that everybody will have like experiences and stuff to contribute, so we'll just have a conversation after that. So we'll kick off with Andrew then.
Alright, so last year I ended up doing a speaking tour of North America, went to 44 different cities. And so that meant speaking in actually about 60 venues, because in a lot of cities I've got in more than one place. It was actually in preparation for this talk, I started to separate out what those venues were. Maybe about a third of them were universities, so I chopped all those out. But the others would qualify in some sort of way as being a social centre. And it kind of depends on what you mean by the term, so I'm going to be using the talk to actually explore that issue. I have a handout. But the other thing I did was I went away and I found our web pages. So if you spot any that are interesting that I mentioned, you'll find the web page is listed on this and the address in case you want to visit. It's sort of an accidental directory. So, geographic range covers, it's two Canadian provinces and I think 18 US states. That sort of top dot up there is Sudbury, which is a mining town in northern Canada. So that's 6 hours drive north of Toronto, down to Miami, of course to Bellingham on the Canadian border up there, and then LA down at the bottom. What is the social centre? It was kind of a question that came up by the tour, because when I was doing the tour, because people referred to the spaces I was going through in different ways. Some of them were called punk houses, some of them were obviously bookshops, some of them were art spaces that were also being used for political projects, some were called info shops, and that seems to be the kind of generic term in the US that people used. And then others were neighbourhood centres. So what are these, which is which, and where are the boundaries? It's useful at the start to say, well, conditions in North America are somewhat different from here in some ways. Importantly, there's a lot less government funding of what might be called quasi-grassroots NGOs. Everything tends to be very much more top-down. So there's not the same potential for a self-created community organisation to get funding. You've a lot of decaying cities. I mean, you've got a picture of the US as kind of typically of the kind of prosperous cities of New York, Boston, LA, Seattle, but there's a hell of a lot of the US that isn't like that, that's falling apart, particularly in the Midwest, the sort of Rust Belt area. And what that means is there's a lot of places where there's extremely cheap rents, or it's extremely cheap to actually purchase a building. You know, you can get houses for as little as $3,000 in places. You have trust fund kids, which we don't really have here. And that's people from proper wealthy backgrounds. I don't mean somebody whose dad is a bank manager, but, you know, somebody who owns a huge string of department stores, and kids have a trust fund set up for them, and actually they have the money to finance projects. So there are particular projects basically are run because one person has a big pot of money. In similar thing, you also have a kind of tradition of charity and philanthropy, particularly from your kind of old money centre in New York. And the very size of the US means that it's possible to do funny things with that, because you're getting money off some New York millionaire for, I don't know, alleviating poverty. He doesn't actually really know or follow exactly how that money is being spent, say, down in Miami. So it's possible to have actually been radical centres with a kind of couple of layers of bureaucracy in between that are filtering the money down to them. And of course, as everybody knows, one big thing in the US is the working class is very racially segregated. A lot of cities are very racially segregated. And I'm mentioning those at the start because I think a common problem with social centre discussions is that people look at stuff elsewhere and imagine it can be implemented in an identical way here without worrying too much about local conditions. On the other hand, we have two important similarities with the US. One is a very weak left. You know, the US left is much weaker even than the Irish left, if that's believable. But what that means is there's very small numbers of people able to do stuff, and it also means a lack of finance in the sense of getting a lot of money from... No, sorry, a small amount of money from a lot of people. That potentially is harder. There's also no real possibility, or at least very limited possibilities, of public political squats, both because the movement is relatively weak and because of the law and order situation. And you get kind of clandestine squats. There have been a few public squats historically, but there's pretty much none currently. Most of the places I'm going to talk about, I only visited once, and that tended to be because I was speaking there. In some cases, I did spend a good bit of time talking with people around the place, but in most others, I spent time talking to the users, and some I didn't either, but just formed an impression from being there. And my point here is that what I'm going to say is it's a very shallow impression. It's not based on huge knowledge about any of these places, but it's also very broad because I ended up in 40 plus of them. So the quantity of observation that builds into a story rather than the quality of any of them. In terms of my personal context, apart from, you know, hanging around Sherman Street. I was also part of the Garden of Delight Collective back in the mid-90s and been in various other similar spaces in Ireland, Britain, Europe and Mexico. So if I start off with the types, so the least convincing ones I found were what are called the punk houses. These aren't set up really as public spaces. They're run by people with a lot of black clothes and piercings, and they're quite suspicious of those that don't conform to this particular look. This one was obviously taken on a good day when they cut the lawn, so it actually looks pretty neat. It's the Pitch Pipe Info Shop in Seattle. Another one I was in was, and actually this is quite a well-organised one, mostly because people are a bit old, I think, the Flying Brick, which is in Richmond, Virginia. A third one I was in was the Firefly in Miami. And what these places tend to be based upon is the possibility of a group of people renting a building relatively cheap, probably opening a library in the building, and it being used for meetings and things, but it doesn't really break out of the kind of cultural circle that they've immediately come out of. The kind of opposite to that are the bookshops. So, you know, this is storefronts in the street, they have definite opening hours. But activity besides selling books tends to be an add-on, and quite often they still end up as quite countercultural spaces. This is Lucy Parsons in Boston. It's moved several times, but it's been going for a long time. I'm not sure either it or Left Bank Books here in Seattle is the oldest one. I think the best of them that I came across is actually, well, this is a rise in Minneapolis. It was very involved in the RNC organizing, and I think got raided as a result of that. Food for Thought Books in Amherst, which is a city of 40,000. And this one's interesting because actually it just looks like a bookshop. Most of the others you'd kind of look at and go, that's a random bookshop. This one just looks like an actual bookshop. And that's Red Emma's in Baltimore. which is one of the more impressively organised ones. In Baltimore, they have the advantage that rents are very low, and also that the people who set them up were all either working as baristas or as carpenters, which meant that they could kit themselves out so it looked nice and they could make good coffee. The last one in a similar category, it's not a bookshop, but that's the AK Press Warehouse in Oakland. Almost another opposite again is the sort of art spaces, and in some ways they're similar to the punk houses, as they're primarily directed at a particular segment of people, but they're also willing to provide space for other purposes. So this is the Tea House in Atlanta, Georgia. This is Sudbury, and I've actually forgotten the name of the place, but it is on the list up there. So Sudbury is that mining town that I mentioned up in the north of Canada. And that's Apocalypse on Broadway, which is in Eugene, Oregon, and basically is used to... It's actually people making films out of it, radical films, but it's also available for other uses as well. Again, they all have websites there, so you can look them up. Another similar familiar use will be office spaces, and these are very typical of the high-rent cities, you know, where basically you have a lot of organisations that can't really afford to rent an office themselves, so they club together and rent one collectively. So this is in Quentro 5 in Boston, which is on the third floor of a building in Chinatown. And this is the Musty Institute in New York. And again, it's the sort of top two floors, and there's probably about 12 groups work out of that place. There was a place in Toronto, I couldn't remember what the hell its name was, and to a certain extent, a really tiny example in Dublin is the last WSM office space. In fact, we share a small meeting space. And then info shops. So they're a cross between the bookshop idea and a sort of attempt at being a community centre. Unlike bookshops, but like punk houses, they often have a focus, say, around a lending library. This is the Black Mangrove in Miami, which at the time I was there, they were just in the process of starting off. This was actually somebody's apartment that they were using half-time as a space, but they'd just moved into their own space and having a kind of goodbye to the space party this weekend, in fact. That's New World in Chicago. That's Stone Soup in Worcester, which is the second biggest city in New England. Boston's the biggest city, this is the second biggest one. In some ways, this reminds me the most of Showman's Free, in fact. It's an interesting building. Worcester's a very depressed city, so basically three people clubbed together and bought a funeral parlour. So it's this big three-story building with a basement, and the basement still has the original kind of sluices, or whatever you call it, where you wash all the blood away when you're processing the bodies. No bodies in it. This is the Civic Media Center, which is in Gainesville, northern Florida. That's actually quite old. It's been running for about 15 years. And it actually set up after Noam Chomsky gave a speech at the local college. People met up after it and decided they should try and create something. So that's where that came about from. Meg Perry Center in Portland, Maine. So that's Portland's on the east coast, not the west coast. And another example of that, that's not it though, was LADA in Philadelphia. And so the last type I'm going to mention briefly is neighbourhood centres. So here the focus is on getting ordinary people from the neighbourhood involved in local activity, although they also provide some of the other functions I've already talked about. This first one's interesting actually. This is the South Californian Library in Los Angeles. And I was rather confused when I was told I'd be speaking there, because I had spoken at another couple of libraries, but I didn't understand why they just said the South California Library. There must be dozens of them in South California. So what this actually is when the Communist Party was being persecuted in the 20s, they wanted someone to put all their documents. So they created a library. And that's actually where the origins of the building is. That's where everything was stored. It's not actually part of the state library system at all. And in fact, the first Los Angeles Anarchist Book Fair is taking place there tomorrow, so I presume it's not simply controlled anymore. This one is, I don't have a picture of it, but the Women's Information Center in Syracuse, which is one of the oldest continuous feminist spaces in North America, I think since about 1976 or so. Thomas Merton Center in Pittsburgh. The Burke Center in San Jose, California. Sky Dragon in Hamilton, that's back in Ontario. Other examples of the same thing were there in Providence, Power U, and like the Miami Workers' Center, both in Miami. Now, none of the categories I've talked about is absolute. The edges cross over into each other, and some in one category would see themselves as at least aiming to be in another. There are some methods in common. For instance, several of both the info shop and community center type places, one of the things they do is they produce local publications with quite big print runs. So in Lab in Philly, for instance, they do a paper called the Definesta, which they do about 3,000 copies of. Gainesville do the Gainesville Iguana, which they do a couple of thousand copies of, so that's really typical. In terms of what the differences are, well, the first sort of difference, I think, in terms of the neighbourhood centres is location. The centres are not only typically shop fronts on streets, I mean, this is right in the centre of Hamilton, but they also were quite often quite careful about the neighbourhood they actually selected to create. So they hadn't so much gone looking for a building and said, we can afford that, so we'll open up a building there. They'd instead gone and said, okay, we want to open up a premises in this particular neighbourhood, and then found what they thought was a suitable premises. In terms of appearance, they were also noticeably different. They typically had an open door all the time. They had, you know, glass frontage windows you could see into it as you were walking by. They had an entrance area where you went in and you were kind of, you know, it felt very accessible in that sort of sense. Another obvious difference was in terms of the people, well, working in it, not necessarily white workers, people aren't necessarily paid, because a lot of them had quite a serious focus on trying to locate from the neighbourhood they were actually organising in. I mean, a lot of the places started up as a kind of outside intervention by, you know, revolutionaries or by activists, but they put a lot of emphasis on building leadership in terms of getting local people involved and trying to work it up so that those people could then take the space over. One of the other really obvious differences as I toured around was in terms of the people who were using the space, and that's because of that connection between race and class in the US under segregation. So one of the things you find is because of, for rent reasons, because it's cheap, you get a lot of info shops located in areas where the surrounding areas majority people of colour. But the actual users of the info shop are nearly all white anarchists, or white activists of one sort or another. So you'd be doing meetings in these places where everybody in the streets outside was black, and nearly everybody at the actual meeting was white, and it felt kind of slightly odd. The neighbourhood centres, you often start at the same thing, where you're quite activists trying to set them up, but the actual users were mostly people of colour, so they were actually bringing in people from the immediate locality in. And in a way, I think that particular issue is much more visible in the States because of that connection between race and class. But you could have the same issue in Dublin, but it would be much more invisible, because everybody's close to the same skin colour, or does not their same historic segregation anyway. That's basically it. I just wanted to do a quick run through, give people an idea of the range of places. And I mean, one of the things I thought was interesting in that when I went over to the States, I had a very dismissive idea of what the American left is, you know, apart from historical stuff like the Black Panthers or, you know, the Detroit sit-down strikes or something. The idea you have is American left today, it's all useless, nobody's doing anything. And it was actually quite inspiring that I was going around all these places and there were centres of one sort or another absolutely everywhere, and a lot of them engaged in really quite good and positive work.
Well, my talk is focusing on one crowd in Glasgow who set up for about a year there called the George's Chalkboard. And it was just in reading this Social Centre book, which we actually have a good section in that Mark wrote. I think some people probably have it, pass it around anyway, but when I was reading that, it just struck me that one particular centre was, or experiment seemed to be very different from the others. For a start off, they were quite outward looking. All the stuff there seemed to be talking about the local communities in a particularly deprived part of Glasgow, but it's also in a part of Glasgow that would have a very long tradition of kind of left-wing organising, tenants' rights and stuff like that. So there was no talk of the internal organisation of the space, white workshops, vegan cooking and so forth. The space seemed to be organised purely as a drop-in centre, and there was no sort of discussion about the internal organisation. Their orientation was very explicitly class struggle. They were, from the start, seemed to be making attempts to coordinate with existing tenants' groups in the area, fighting for local youth clubs, etc. They also had extremely ambitious aims, astonishingly ambitious aims, probably overly ambitious aims, They say in their point six of their sort of project that they wish to generalise local struggles into wider tenants' campaigns and develop a citywide tenants' movement. They want to develop a counter-power to the Glasgow Council Housing Association, which will be based on tenants' groups and would aim to take over council housing and to actually challenge and seize aspects of state power in the city of Glasgow. So that's pretty ambitious. They're still going. The centre only ran for a year, but they still have a blog, and they still they've organised some conferences and various things since then, including a recent Glasgow Residents Network conference, which included workshops on gentrification, housing associations, rent restructuring review, and an open discussion on antisocial behaviour, local crime in the area, and so forth. So if you, the handout there, they actually kind of list what they consider some of their achievements. Say chalkboard and the tenancy around us in conjunction with local residents achieved quite a bit in the year. Defeated the local yuppie development valued at about 15 million. Tree lifts fixed on the local St. George's estate valued 700,000. Meeting with Deputy Government Minister for Education on the issue of youth club. Investment of about 300,000 in local youth facilities and the exposure of much local political corruption. I think the people in Glasgow were inspired by the two older groups in London which came out of the poll tax, which is the Hackney Independent and the Haringey Solidarity Group. I have a little bit of their bump just come off the internet. They were over recently. WSM had a school on community organising and some of the people came up. The interesting thing about the Hackney Group in London is that they freely admit that to some extent they're a service provision group. They run an office, a clinic, people come, say I've got troubles with my landlord, and they do some of the jobs that a TD in Ireland might do. They sort of put people in the way of agencies that can help them explain the laws, etc. But then what they usually do to follow that on is they have a thing which they describe as direct action casebook, which basically means when you reach the limits of what's legally available, you then get the people together and say, well, we want to campaign on this, and do you want to take it further? And then they, move beyond the legal means. But they start with service provision, but then try and work it into actually actively involving people in struggles. The Haringey and Hackney groups would see themselves as a skill-sharing network that work with local campaigns and sometimes try to initiate them. They also produced a totally independent newsletter that's going around there. Recently, they organised the Haringey Independence Day, 250 people and 30 local groups coming together for meetings and practical activities. The chalkboard article, what I'm basically talking about is the possibility of setting up neighbourhood centres as such that are also social centres, but that respond to local conditions and what people want in an area, as opposed to social centres that are just lefty activists getting together to do various things. Now, I'm not opposed to that, wouldn't be here if I was, but I'm thinking for the future, and it's ambitious, it's like, how would we actually go about, could we actually go into neighbourhoods and begin to sort of develop these sort of things, or would even a need, would actually people in some neighbourhoods where there are cutbacks, which is happening right now, where community workers, people have been taken out, and places have been closed down, will people actually get together and say, oh, we want to keep this going? I think the chalkboard thing is probably, if you read it, it's very clunky and sort of mechanistic. I think they've got some ideas from the Scottish Socialist Party, and also from, there's an anarchist called Murray Bookchin, who talks about libertarian municipalism. So they start talking very quickly about dual power and stuff, and it seems a bit like these fellas are, losing the run of themselves altogether. To look at Dublin at the moment, I don't know whether many genuine tenants' associations exist. I mean, for example, there was a campaign around O'Devonley Gardens recently, and there was big protests, and a lot of people were probably on them outside City Hall and so forth. But when you actually look at the campaign, a lot of the work was actually done by people who were, very left-wing, very good community workers, but they're actually people that were paid to be in there. And when you actually look at estates like O'Devonley, there's only about 80 people there. There was 400 people there. So even where you see what appear to be good campaigns of local people, you find that to a large extent those people aren't there, and the conditions are very, very difficult. I was involved in the Garden of Delight the same as Andrew in the 1990s, and we did a little bit of trying to work with people who lived in that part of the Liberties, but there's problems with it. Like, we found ourselves becoming sort of a free creche for kids, a place for bored teenagers to hang out in the afternoons, and most worryingly, we started to become popular with some of the local heroin addicts, and we found it's something we weren't equipped or trained to deal with in any way. So I think any initiative like this has to be built in tandem from the beginning with local people and has to respond to a demand for something that's already there. I think to build this sort of neighbourhood centre is quite a massive project of work. And it would have to be based around an already existing campaign for a service, or maybe an attempt to replace a cutback like a community centre, a creche, a youth club or something that was actually being closed down where people live, and they said, well, maybe we could try our hands at getting involved in doing this. You will also find, if you try and set up neighbourhood centres like this, that there will be an element of what's called service provision, you know, advising people about their rights, explaining the law, doing stuff like what politicians do to a certain extent, but then maybe trying to take that a little bit further. So, to set up a sort of neighbourhood community-based centre, I think is quite a different task than the political social space. There's room for both, they both have different roles. I think that setting up a neighbourhood centre is a very big job. I'm not sure if it's really possible in Dublin at the moment, but ideally I'd like to see the growth of both types of social centres and the building of natural, organic links between them around shared equipment, speaking tours, exhibitions, workshops and stuff like that. That's me.
There's a few different things I want to talk about, so I'll try and do it in more or less coherent kind of a way. Basically, I was living in Barcelona for a couple of years and had a lot of conversations with people who were involved in different social centre projects there. So that's where, and I visited a lot of projects, that's where the information that I'm basically going to be talking about comes from. And also there's a kind of a webzine called Transverso that publishes simultaneously, like in German, Italian, Spanish and English, each every so often, and there's an issue on social centres there, so some of what I'm talking about comes from that too. So basically, you know, one of the things that most you know attracted me to social centre politics in the first place was one of my friends is involved in a social centre called SECO in Madrid, and their kind of symbol or mascot is the Pink Panther. And I asked them, why is that? Like, why have you got the Pink Panther as their symbol? Because it seemed a bit ridiculous. Like, but they said that, and apparently this comes from Deleuze, this French philosopher. Apparently this guy Deleuze says that nowadays resistance, political resistance, has to be like the Pink Panther, because when the Pink Panther finds himself in a situation that he can't get out of, or some kind of impossible scenario where there's no kind of apparent escape, then he just paints a door himself and walks out of it. And that's very much, for me, how I understand social centre politics, as a kind of an emergency exit, or like an escape hatch, a collective eject button, or what Deleuze, again, that philosopher calls a line of flight. And so what I'm going to talk about really is the kind of context that those social centres come from. Because I think without understanding the context, it's difficult to understand the kind of the full political potential of these projects. And then I'm basically going to talk a little bit about how they emerge, the kind of history, and then what are the characteristics of these projects, basically what do they do, what does what they do mean politically. So the context, I suppose, is, and I mean, I don't want to get into talking about, you know, capitalism too much, but that basically is the context, and particularly the new forms of capitalism, and especially the complete saturation of human life by capitalism. So what I'm talking about here is very much the way in which the logic of capital exploitation and commodification and those things has very much broken down the walls of the factory and escaped out into every aspect of social life. So you can think about for example, you know, in Tesco now they have these automatic checkout things where you check out your own stuff. So this is kind of a paradigmatic example of where you're consuming, right? At the same time you're working because you're the checkout operator. And at the same time, and even more kind of disturbingly, you're also producing information about yourself, about your own wants and desires, which is then sold as a commodity. So you're not going to work, you don't have a boss, you're not in a factory, you're not being told what to do, and at the same time, without realizing it, you're an incredibly, incredibly productive actor. And this is a completely new, I feel, situation that calls for, you know, a really new analysis, and it's a situation that I suppose we don't really fully understand. But another example could be the kind of proliferation of caring work, let's say, childcare, people looking after the elderly, you know, migrants looking after the elderly, that kind of work, where what's being sold is care or a caring relationship. So what's being sold, it's not a product, it's not a commodity, it's a social relationship, it's basically human life itself that's being sold, human relationships. And this is the context, really, where capitalism, where we feel completely immersed in it, like trapped in a net, where there doesn't seem to be any particular point to attack, and where there doesn't seem to be a particular kind of way out. And this is very much how these social scientists I'm talking about would kind of describe the situation that they're in. To move on to kind of the historical emergence of these social scientists, they were basically, they're coming from the autonomous movement in Spain in the 80s, like, so the big social centres in Spain in the 80s would have been the laboratory in Madrid, and the Princesa in Barcelona. And I suppose by the time the anti-globalisation movement came around in the late 90s, these places had become very much kind of what Andrew was talking about, the kind of punk houses, to some extent. Now, I don't know, I wasn't there, okay, but this is very much the kind of what I've been told by people. I'm sure it was more complicated at the time. But, you know, there was very much a language, a self-referential language, where basically nobody outside knew really what people were talking about. There was very much an aesthetic that went with it. And it was basically what we, you know, the problems we'd associate with, like, the political ghetto type scenario. And I suppose it was probably also a kind of depressing time. You know, you'd had the collapse of the workers' movement and all the rest of it. A lot of repression and so on. And then all of a sudden, you know, Seattle came along and there was a big explosion of activity. And all of a sudden the social centres found themselves in a completely different context where political activity seemed to be kind of spontaneously happening all over the place. And that led them to a number of kind of reflections, one of them being they didn't feel particularly equipped to engage with what was happening. They, you know, people kind of didn't really expect it, and, you know, it came out of nowhere. And at the same time, it seemed that there was a new context that demanded a new kind of reflection, basically. And out of this process of, you know, all this activity going on, and some reflection, and also activist research or militant research, where people were kind of actively studying the context they were in, the cities they were in, the different types of conflicts that were going on. This kind of set of projects came together, you know. So obviously it wasn't a decision that people took, but a number of different projects emerged, and then a kind of a network emerged. So the projects would be, the ones that would kind of spring to mind would be the El Teneo de la Candela, which is in Terrassa outside Barcelona, Exit, which is in Barcelona, Seco in Madrid, Patio Maravillas, which is in Madrid as well, the Casa de Iniciativas and the Casa Invisible in Malaga, and there's a few more. There's also some internationally that I know there. These guys are quite related to, like, ESC in Rome. There's one in Verona, I think, or I'm not sure the name of it, and one called Rogue in Ljubljana. Anyway, so what are the kind of characteristics of these new social centres? What do they do, and how does what they do correspond to this kind of context of that I was talking about earlier? And basically, this the key thing I've kind of identified and basically emphasize. Well, I'm sure everybody would have a different opinion, but the key thing I'd emphasize is that they act as a kind of an interface or a melting pot. Like, I know that phrase is a bit crap, but a melting pot or a kind of a point of encounter where different individuals' experiences, trajectories, and projects can come together. So we know that, like, in Seattle, the big thing was there was, like, truckers and there was environmental activists coming together, and this was incredibly, you know, exciting and kind of unheard of. And it seemed that that's where the kind of political potential of the movement lay, in this creating this kind of point of encounter where a bunch of different people who were having kind of very different experiences were able to create an element of a collective element of their struggle without having a, you know, like, you know, a platform or like becoming part of a political party or whatever. In Seattle or in similar things, this happens, you know, but it happens very much like a little spasm, you know, and it's incredibly intense, and then it's gone. And a social centre basically gives a physical space that allows for that same kind of power to have a stability and a continuity, and maybe to kind of crystallise or grow in strength or become more kind of productive. And this is, you know, this is a really extremely important point, you know, because if you think about, you know, right, to take an example from Marx, okay, that, you know, Marx's famous thing, capitalism creates its own grave diggers because, you know, it puts people all together in the factory and then exploits the fuck out of them, and that's not going to work out very well. That basically doesn't happen in contemporary capitalism. So Marx, you know, is a real important point for Marx. Communism, the revolution, depended on the factory. No factory, there can't be a Soviet without a factory. It's ridiculous to think of the two things together separately because it depends on that material, everyday, collective activity in the factory is the kind of the base of substance that forms the kind of which allows the resistance to be effective and to be kind of democratic. And we don't basically have that today, you know. We're all just, you know, one of the ways that the neoliberal city, or whatever you want to call it, is governed is that everybody's in their little box, you know. You have the migrants over here, and then you have your workers' issues over here, and then, you know, you have gender equality over here, and you've got civil marriage for gay, for, you know, minority sexualities over here. And this is, you know, this is an extremely successful strategy. And in order for some kind of counter power, as Crosby was saying, to emerge, that needs to happen somewhere. It needs to happen in a physical space. It needs to happen through human contact and relations. And a social centre makes that kind of possible. And I think that's been kind of linking together these kind of different but similar lines of flight, and these kind of different attempts to resist or get some distance from the hold that the logic of capital or money relations have over our life. There's a lot of different people who are trying to escape that, you know, in different ways. And a social centre can be like a node where these different experiences pass through. And then they can have more potential. And this also means de-individualising the conflicts that we experience every day, because, you know, today's capitalism is just as conflictual as earlier forms of capitalism, but we experience that as individuals, and that's one of the reasons why it's so brutal. And by coming together in a shared space, it's also a chance to kind of de-individualise those conflicts and that brutality that we're all experiencing every day, and to share experiences and kind of have mutual kind of support or sharing knowledges and so on and so forth, and to create a collectivity from that. So it's very much about kind of, you know, it's very much about making a decision to produce collectivity, to make, you know, to say that that's what you want to do, and that can't be just some, you can't just wait for a class to emerge, so to speak, you know, or a particular, yeah, you can't just wait for it to emerge, you know, it's about making it yourself, basically. And some of the, so more kind of specifically, some of the stuff that goes on in these social centres would be, I've kind of divided them up into a few things here based on an article that I was reading. So the first one would be the cultural stuff, and I think this is kind of particularly interesting because you know, sometimes we, you know, there's a critique of social movements or social centres and squats that they're countercultural or that they're just cultural, you know. But I think if we take seriously the idea that the capitalism today is largely concerned with the production of culture, like ideas, desires, language, styles, fashions, you know, all those things, social relations, then culture is not something that we can really separate from work anymore. I think the distinction between culture and work, where culture is not that serious and work is, really doesn't have that much meaning in contemporary capitalism. So when you look at cultural production, you're also looking at a form of work, really, a kind of cooperative, collective form of work that's happening in these social centres, around things like copyleft, creative commons, hackers, and this kind of thing, you know. So you'd have, you know, independent cinema, documentaries, a lot of artists using spaces, theatre groups, all this kind of stuff. Lots of people who are cultural workers, but who don't want their product to just be captured and turned into a commodity, you know, to be captured in these kind of incredibly insidious circuits of capitalist exploitation that are, you know, that are out there. So that's one kind of element. A second element is what you could call the kind of, well, I don't know, post-colonial element, right? That our cities nowadays, they're in Europe, you know, capital cities, they're characterized by not a lot of diversity in terms of people's, you know, nationality, experiences of migration, you know. So if you look at Dublin, you know, it's, you can't really ignore it, and we're right in the middle of it here in this area, and that links into the next part, which is what they call the offices of social rights, which is, I think, something that was first developed in Italy, but there's around six in Spain now, and they're very much what Crosley was talking about, a mix of service provision with an element of direct action or mobilisation. So, and there's been some big, big successes in this area, extremely inspiring events, like from more kind of everyday things like people getting residency documents, you know, going to a social centre, an undocumented migrant, you know, going to a social centre and coming out 4 months later having residency documents and having rights as a human being, which they didn't have before, you know, which is a massive thing in itself, to more bigger, kind of bigger picture stuff. And this May Day in Terrassa, the Senegalese Association and Association of what they call top manteros over there, which is the people who sell, like, you know, Gucci bags and stuff on the blankets, they're mainly Senegalese in Barcelona, along with the people from the social centre, the precarious workers and different groups, squatted, or they occupied, sorry, the social welfare, Department of Social Welfare of the City Council. And they demanded that, one of their demands is that the police stop doing identity checks on the guys who are selling the stuff on the street, basically, because their life was like a nightmare, you know, because they had to do it to make money, but at the same time, every time they did it, you could be, you know, detained, and then you'd be in a migrant rights or a detention centre, yes. And you'd be, you know, and then you could be deported or whatever. And they managed to get that. They managed to get in an area, a particular area of the city where they wouldn't be. And they had a meeting with the mayor and everything. They managed to achieve that. But there was, in a particular area of the city, they wouldn't be stopped by the cops. And then there's the main issues they focus on, based on a kind of analysis of the context. The main issues they focus on is precarious work, migration, and housing. So in Barcelona, there's another one, Magdalenas, that have Project for Really Public Housing, and they help people who are being evicted. And then there's the Precarious Agency, which is one run by a group of feminists, and they work with women mainly who are involved in different types of work that are very precarious, especially care and labour. And that kind of stuff, like domestic work, and also there's a lot of migrants working there, so that's kind of crossover. So there's a few different projects going on there, and they're very much about, not so much service provision, they wouldn't describe it as that, but certainly a kind of an idea that we're kind of in this thing together, And I might have citizenship and you mightn't, but neither of us alone are capable at the moment of providing any kind of resistance to what's happening in terms of capitalism, in terms of neoliberalism, do you know what I mean? And those have been some pretty successful kind of experiences. And then the last two things is, one is the kind of education thing, which is the idea of having a kind of a permanent educational element to kind of, I think Sergio Bologna called it collective intelligence as a kind of a collective immune system that you kind of build up to vaccinate yourself against all the poisonous ideas that are out there. And so there's been some great ones there. The Nomad University in Spain is, you know, doing some great work, research, seminars, different stuff like that. And I know, like in Italy-esque, I think they've had in Rome, they've had a pretty big success with that, and they've even managed, I think, that the university gives accreditation for the courses they put on. So there's courses in the social centre in, for example, contemporary capitalism, and the students from the university can go there, and that would be accredited as if it was in the university. So that's an example of an extremely high level of kind of power from autonomy, from coming from an autonomous position. Or a high level of kind of productivity, or I don't know how to describe it. Then the last thing is the idea of a new relationship with the institutions, right? So moving away from, well, this isn't really relevant here, but over there, you know, autonomy would have been very much about, like, absolutely no talking to the state. Squat and resist, you know, that's the big slogan. We're not going to talk to anybody here who is kind of involved in capitalism. And the idea now is, well, people describe it as being able to look the institutions, like the state, kind of eye to eye, and kind of recognize that they exist, but also that we exist and that we have a certain amount of demands, and to start a kind of a conversation so that can happen. You've got people who've managed to get negotiated buildings where the city council gives there's an eviction process, social centre activists demand a space, there's, you know, different kinds of stuff goes on, you know, blah, blah, blah. Basically, they end up being able to put enough resistance out there to get a space of their own, or they might get 80% of their rent paid or something like that. In the Candela and Terrassa, they get an awful lot of money, but they get pretty good amount of money off the city council to do conferences and seminars and projects with the social rights office. And this means basically they can stop spending all their time trying to fight eviction after eviction after eviction, which is what people spent a lot of the 90s doing. And they can start basically doing what they want to do, which is, you know, the kind of stuff I've been talking about. So just to sum up then, I mean, for me, it's very much, you know, this idea of a line of flight, or, you know, this kind of Pink Panther idea, it's very much, you know, it's not a defensive idea, it's not an escapist escape, it's kind of an escape into, away from the kind of individualized, melancholic, atomized way that we experience the brutality and the monotony and the absolute meaninglessness of capitalism today, but it's an escape into conflict with that system and with that form of life, and in that kind of process, by getting together with people and making this kind of collective trajectory, you know, there's a real chance that kind of new projects and new political subjects and new actors and new collectives and stuff can emerge and can have a kind of a continuity and a stability that can make them become, like the Chalkboard Centre wanted to become, a counterpower in the city and a living, breathing, alternative way of life, which it's, you know, people can recognise that it's just better than what's on offer at the moment. So I'll leave it at that.
Because last time I was talking about one specific project in Rome, Acrobats, that was involved, and is involved particularly about the precarity and housing issue in Rome. But this time I was just thinking about giving like a brief like history about how social centres came up in Italy. It's very confused, and because I wrote it in half day actually, so. So I'll try to just to give you a few information about the dynamics that happened in Italy. Briefly, we can say that social centers in Italy were born in the mid of the 80s, after the big movement of the 70s that, particularly in Italy, aimed truly to make a revolution and believed that it was possible at that time. So the aftermath of that big experience of struggles, of the struggles of the 70s, actually were years that were marked by three elements. There was a brutal repression, a large use of heroin, and individualism. There were three elements that were used by the power to destroy and wipe out an entire revolutionary generation. So those who overcame somehow the 80s tried to resist. So the 80s somehow represented years of an extreme resistance, both cultural and political, where the social centers that were already, some of them were already set up, represented for sure an important phase in order to occupy again urban territories, not just in a physical way, but also in the language, experiencing new forms of political expression that was far from the class struggle of the previous years, but that was more focused on the issue of being present in the society where we are living in our metropolis, in what we might call in an interclass vision, not more so class struggle. Anyways, social centers, so we can say they are the revival of an autonomous movement that, unlike the one of the 70s, starting thinking and acting without being a political organization, in the meaning that with a strong identity that we had in the 70s, but giving a lot of importance, as you were saying before, at the cultural issue, where the underground and not commodified, I guess you'd say, yeah, production of cultural production was the core of the of those years of the 80s. It was not by chance, in fact, that the punk first and rap and reggae later in Italy represent the important self-production experiences in all forms. Like in the 80s, we had like social centers were self-producing stuff, like cultural stuff. There were bands that were self-producing themselves, punk bands. Later in the 90s, there was the so-called POS, where the Italian version of the USA rap. So one of the most important aspects, for sure, was the cultural factor was very strong, because it meant reject the commodification of life, and the need to express practically, a new and revolutionary forms of society. So at that time, social centers starting representing not the means, but the end at the same time. So it was a kind of the idea of getting back the spaces and time to attack and counterattack, and not just to resist, but to start a new life, to start a new way of living and a new way of socializing. And I try to divide like the experiences of social centers in different phases. So we started with the mid of the 80s. One thing that characterized all the phase of the social centers, anyways, was like and one of the most interesting thing was like the any time what happened was like the. There was a loss of identity, of the strong identity of the previous years, because new subjects and new languages were mixing. And this created new momentum, I don't know how to say, created new new phases, and just to move forward. So it happened in the 80s when, for instance, in Rome, there was they still on, is one of the oldest social. I have even pictures, but I don't know if I have time to show them. An old military fortress, Forte Prenestina, was occupied, And in that case, for instance, in the mid-80s, we found like people coming from the 70s, like late Leninists, you know, leftist people, extra-parliamentary, mixing and meeting with the punks. You know, that was kind of unusual, but it worked, actually, because both of them needed a place to start again, needed a place to organize their ideas and move forward. So the another element was like the space. For sure, the space is an important element. Like social centers can be thought without a physical space. The space is the base of everything. That why there's even the idea of social centers as free autonomous zones, where the where occupying a space meant not only to free a portion of territory, but like to free space, to free space, but to free at the same time our vital time. All those elements they are denied by the so-called market society or market city. You know, the idea that our city is actually that our territories are ruled and controlled just by profit. And the idea, moreover, that the buildings that they were squatted and occupied were somehow liberated by even the real estate speculation, giving more importance to the action of squatting. So another important phase of the social census in Italy was the end of the 80s and the beginning of the 90s. In particular, in 1989, there was a huge student movement that was fighting against the reform of the system education. In that case, for months, the movement was called La Pantera, the Panther, and because there was a panther in those days that escaped from the zoo in Rome, so there was all this imaginary of now this panther that got free, and so the movement called themselves Panther. So the Pantera gave actually new nourishment to social centers. For months there were people, there was a mixing of the different subjects. Students and the Roman movement and the Italian movement were meeting up in university and starting talking about the production of culture, about the properties, about knowledge. So, like after the end of occupation of university, it was kind of natural to go back to their territories and get back the city. So, a lot of social centers started to spread all over the country in 1989 and the 90s. So we find social centers from the big cities to the small towns, everywhere. Like the word self management spread everywhere. Everybody's talking about self management, and that it expresses itself in different ways. So there are social centers that are more focused on the territory that surrounds the area. There are those who are more interested in producing underground culture. There are those that have a stronger political identity. But despite all those differences, the most important thing was that, again, social center represented a strong link, a strong tie, and everybody was feeling as being part of a common path. And that was what really made the movement again up. So that was most of the top of the movement. So that in the 90s, we can see that, for instance, Leoncavallo is one of the most important social centers in Milan. In 1994, he's been evicted by the local administration, who was ruled by Lega Nord. There was a far right party. Lega Nord put eviction of Leoncavallo at the first point of its agenda. But Leoncavallo was the movement at that time was so strong. The movement social center was so strong that there was a public call for defending Leoncavallo, and the eviction turned against the local administration that was obliged to resign. So the Lega Nord now is again in the power, not in Milan, but Leoncavallo for sure is still there. A lot of things has changed. I mean, you know, in the years, maybe some social centers in Italy are not completely, they don't agree completely with what now Dokvar, for instance, is doing, but for sure it's a part of experience of what happened in those years. And it represented also an important, like, before the 1994, when he was evicted, different time. Oh, no, in 1994, sorry. Again, there was a big demonstration, again, to defend the Loncavallo, where for the first time I saw in my life, where the demonstrators were chasing after the cops while beating a retreat. So there was a very high level of conflict and confrontation in those years that, of course, marked like as the social centers became an important element in the Italian political scene. That meant different things. It meant also that the ruling class tried to oppose them in different ways by evicting them, buying them in a political meaning, of course, so by co-opting them. And so since then, like, a new phase start again. New phases where some sold themselves, some, you know, went on resisting, so there was a new phase of resistance, actually. Until 2000, the new social centers start, we have new social centers in Italy, especially, as he said, Rome, the new generation of social centers, some said the second generation, the third generation. So we have places as Capro, but we're starting talking about knowledge, about precarity, and starting campaign to face and to organize themselves against those issues. But that's more or less what I wanted to say. Then maybe, I mean, I don't know, we can add something else later when if you're going to do a bit of something. That's it for me.
Okay, so maybe just if people might have like comments or experiences with social scientists that they want to contribute, or they might have like specific questions about some of the stuff we've been talking about. So, maybe you wanna? Anything?
Just one very small comment. Just because in the summer you sent me some of this stuff from the second generation social centres. I know you were saying, and I think they're quite right, is to try and escape from inward looking and certain use of language and, you know, aesthetics and all that. But by God, they are saturated with arcane references to Deleuze, Spinoza. Some of the language is very, very complicated.
Right.
And in the same way as these chalkboards, people use some very old school, almost Leninist-y rhetoric there, and I think you've really got to watch that stuff. And because I think a lot of your talk was very good, Mick, and I actually think that I would agree with a lot of what they are saying, but it's just the way they say it sometimes is a little bit torturous. The one thing I'm wondering about is this whole commitment to doing a massive amount of education and integrating it in to the existing academia and universities, which are quite elitist. And I wonder, are they doing themselves any favours in some ways? Because are you just going to become a sort of a very cheap educational wing of the state where they can get very intelligent people to do a lot of work for them for next to nothing? And yet it's still tied into academia, so it's not really tied into, you know, just, you know, normal people around them or whatever. So it's just one possible criticism.
But are you talking about the language or about the topic? Because...
No,
so just the language that they use about the topic, because the topic is very close to actually the daily life that we are living, like especially all the comments about that was saying about the production of life beyond work, that we are at work even we are not working. It's something that if you use an easy language, it's quite easy to let understand anyone, because if you think about how labor changed lately, for instance, what is required when you work is like your interpersonal skills, like your communication skills, your ability to relate to others and to
quite high.
So that's what I'm was not so used before, and then so it's something that you don't learn anywhere. You don't even learn at university. It's part of your life. It's your way of living. It's your way of being. If it's you know, so it's quite easy to let understand like the transformation that happened, for instance. So maybe you were talking more about the language, or I don't know.
Yeah, just the way that some of those documents were presented is very, 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 very obscure. I mean, it's like, because I study philosophy, and it's like some of the worst, because like, Deleuze has some great ideas, but it's extremely impenetrable, you know. He's not the first person I've run to for inspiration on social change.
No.
And it's Spinoza, multitude, it's medieval philosophy, some of it. And some of it, it's enjoyable in a way, you know, if you're into ideas and discussion and so on. But I'm just thinking, if you want to present yourself as something that's kind of real to you, I don't mean that in any patronising way, because I do agree people's educational level is miles higher than it was even 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and continuing to rise. So there's no way you should patronise people. But another way, I don't like sometimes language is used to totally confuse and bamboozle people as well, and kind of give you some sort of privileged access to some amazing innovations from somewhere. I don't know. But
did you want to do that, Jeff?
Yeah, I was going to, you related thing, the idea that, you know, some of the education courses and social centres were now being recognised by the local college and integrated into it, is something that made me think, well, is that a victory, or, you know, is that kind of cheap labour and actually integration of movements in, because, you know, universities produce elite ideology, basically, that's what their role is, as much as anything else, so I was kind of critical of that, but more so, what I found interesting in terms of what you were talking about, and in fact what I tended to disagree with more, was not so much what these places were doing, but the whole premise it was based on. I mean, I'm really unsure about this idea that capitalism has fundamentally changed, you know, that class society has. I mean, I think what's happened is that these ideas have come out of a particular sector of the world economy that was once very industrialized and has become deindustrialized, and they've mistaken their experiences of industrialization as typical for the experiences of the world. You know, so for instance, when you were talking about Marx and, you know, how Marx was writing depended on the factories, but factories don't exist anymore. I mean, that's really not true at all. I mean, you know, when Marx was writing all his stuff, there were almost no factories anywhere. You know, they were quite a new idea. Nowadays, there's, you know, many more billions of people working in factories than there would have been at that time. But it's not necessarily in the industrial centres of the Ruhr or in Milan or, you know, in London or whatever else. It's moved elsewhere. It's China, whatever. It's Mexico. It's South America. I'm not sure how new the idea of, you know, work being about more than just selling your labour power, but selling the whole kind of human relationship life thing is about. I mean, whatever about doing your own checkout in Tesco, you know, it's a running, I don't know if the joke is the right word, but cliche that the oldest profession in the world is prostitution. Or maybe it's the second oldest, and the oldest is actually the military. And both of those are examples of jobs where you give your entire body, you know, to the job in a very, you know, and they go back to, you know, certainly both brothels and armies existed in ancient Rome, and may go further back again. So I've just, like, a lot of the rhetoric about the world has changed completely. I'm really not sure it's true. You know, I think, of course, things have changed, and things always change. But in terms of where it's come from, and I think you see the same phenomenon in the a lot of the writing coming out of kind of Detroit in that period as well, and part of the States that went through the same experience. So there were once huge factories there, there were once huge concentrations, and there was a particular type of left there. And then capitalism moved those jobs. And the people who were left kind of theorized this into a capitalism has changed idea. But I don't know if it did, actually. I think it moved.
Yeah, I'd like to respond to that if unless anybody else wants to say. But I mean, I suppose, I mean, there's danger getting too much into discussion about capitalism. But there's kind of two ways you can answer that question. One is like a theoretical way, and another one is talk about your life. And maybe I'll just do those. Like, we talk about those theories. I mean, one hand, right, the whole Marx thing. Marx talked about factories. There wasn't that many factories, but Marx's point was factories tend to become the hegemonic form of production and what most produces value. So it's not a question of quantity, it's a question of quality. So just like that today, there's still lots of factories, there's still lots of people who work in peasants-type production, but what tends to become the most dynamic sector of the economy in the part of the world where I live, which is the only part of the world I know anything about, is this element of work that I've been talking about, or production. So that you find where even if you do go into a factory today, you don't find this like incredibly mechanical and monotonous work where people aren't allowed to speak, and people are often encouraged to communicate. There's a lot of horizontal communication, and the work is layered. There's constant communication going from one to the other, and what's produced in the factory depends on information that's constantly coming in from market research. So that the factory itself is absolutely dependent on constant input of really up-to-date information on consumer trends and can't survive without it. That's one argument, but it's probably very, you know, nobody knows the answer to that question, I would say, like, it's still up for debate. But then you can talk about your own life. I've never met anybody that, to my knowledge, worked in a factory. I don't know anybody who produces an object and gets paid for it. For producing an object, a material object. Every single person I know works in immaterial labour. What they produce is either ideas or communication or something like that. And I think if you're in that context, you have to respond to that context. And I'm no doubt in my mind that if we did a go around in this room, you're not going to find very many people who are producing physical things. And you'll probably find that most people work on and off, they try to work part-time when they can, they might try and go back and study for a few years, and then they change in jobs all the time. And this is a new scenario. And this new scenario calls for new ideas and new strategies.
But I think one point that Andrew's making, first of all, this country's never been industrialized except for the Northeast. Mm. And besides that, there's never been any whole scale. The Walls, arguably, we're moving. You could actually argue, over the last 30 years, we're actually moving closer to industrialisation because it's been a move off the land into cities, so you could actually tend. But I don't think the conversation here tonight is actually about capitalism, but it's about social change. Any social change, because the nature of the world we live in is a global idea now. There's no point to Ireland having social change because the US could put a carrier fleet in Dublin Bay and just like force you to stop. It's a very global thing. And actually, China, for example, in the last year, there were 70,000 uprisings in China. Or a lot of it linked into the fact that it's an industrialised society. So I don't think you can actually ignore that. I don't think, again, though, actually, Europe's deindustrialisation in certain places, not as, like, for example, Poland is not. Like, certain parts of the Eastern Bloc are being industrialised because now they provide, they're not a danger zone, but they have cheap labour, which is, like, that really beautiful, for in terms of capitalists, they're entering into it. But even, say, what I'm more interested in is take what you're saying is true, that I mean, to move into a new form of organisation, like, I don't know, I imagine most of you here would accept that capitalism will only end through a revolution. It will not in any way. It's not going to implode, and probably if it does, what will come out of it would be a hell of a lot worse than what we live in today. There's some barbarism. So if you want that, what I'm interested in is how does the social centre see itself in relation to a revolutionary movement? Is it the organ that, say, in syndicalism a union is, or in Leninism the party is, or where does the idea of revolution, or whatever people want to call but like that, confronting the political and economic power that is, I just can't see myself, like I'm just trying to envisage it. I can't see how that can come from that.
This audio is a recording of a meeting at Shomer Spree on the topic of social centres. In it, several people give their experiences of different social centres in Europe and North America. You can find more audio at www.wsm.ie.